Speechware, Document 44, Industrial Democracy. From an address delivered in Cairo, Illinois, October 3, 1907. I am glad to have the chance to speak to you today. This is the heart of what may be called the Old West, which we now call the Middle West, using the term to denote that great group of rich and powerful states which literally forms the heart of the country. It is a region whose people are distinctively American in all their thoughts, in all their ways of looking at life, and in its past and its present alike it is typical of our country. The oldest men present can still remember the pioneer days, the days of the white tilted ox wagon, of the emigrant, and of the log cabin in which that emigrant first lived, when he settled to his task as a pioneer farmer. They were rough days, days of hard work, and the people who did that work seemed themselves uncouth and forbidding to visitors who could not look below the surface. It is curious and amusing to think that even as genuine a lover of his kind, a man normally so free from national prejudices as Charles Dickens, should have selected the region where we are now standing as the seat of his forlorn Eden in Martin Chuzzlewit. The country he so bitterly assailed is now one of the most fertile and productive portions of one of the most fertile and productive agricultural territories in all the world, and the dwellers in this territory represent a higher average of comfort, intelligence, and sturdy capacity for self-government than the people in any tract of like extent in any other continent. The land teems with beauty and fertility, and but a score of years after Dickens wrote it was shown to be a nursery and breeding ground of heroes, of soldiers and statesmen of the highest rank, while the rugged worth of the rank and file of the citizenship rendered possible the deeds of the mighty men who led in council and in battle. This was the region that brought forth mighty Abraham Lincoln, the incarnation of all that is best in democratic life, and from the loins of the same people, living only a little farther south, sprang another of our greatest presidents, Andrew Jackson, Old Hickory, a man who made mistakes like most strong men, but a man of iron will and incorruptible integrity, fearless, upright, devoted to the welfare of his countrymen, bone on our bone and flesh on our flesh, a typical American, if ever there was one. I commend a careful reading of Martin Chuzzlewit to the pessimists of today, to the men who, instead of fighting hard to do away with abuses, while at the same time losing no jot of their buoyant hopefulness for the country, insist that all our people, socially and industrially, in their private lives no less than as politicians, newspapermen and businessmen, are at a lower ebb than ever before. If ever any one of you feels a little downcast over the peculiarly gloomy view of the present taken by some well-meaning pessimist of today, you will find it a real comfort to read Martin Chuzzlewit, to see what a well-meaning pessimist of the past thought on our people 65 years ago, and then think of the extraordinary achievement, the extraordinary gain, morally no less than materially, of those 65 years. Dickens can be read by us now with profit, Elijah Pogram, Hannibal Choilop, Jefferson Brick, and scatter have their representatives today, plenty of them, and the wise thing for us to do is to recognize that these are still types of evil in politics, journalism, business, and private life, and to war against them with all our hearts. But it is rank folly to regard these as the only, or the chief, types in our national life. It was not of much consequence whether Dickens made such an error or not, but it would be of great consequence if we ourselves did, for a foolish pessimism is an even greater foe of healthy national growth than a foolish optimism. It was not that Dickens invented characters or scenes that had no basis in fact. In the contrary, what he said was true, as far as it went. The trouble was that out of many such half-truths he made a picture which, as a whole, was absurd. For often a half-truth is the most dangerous falsehood. It would be simply silly to be angry over Martin Chuzzlewit. In the contrary, read it, be amused by it, profit by it, and don't be misled by it. Keep a lively watch against the present-day Pograms and Bricks, but above all, distrust the man who would persuade you to feel downhearted about the country because of these same Pograms and Bricks, past or present. It would be foolish to ignore their existence, or the existence of anything else that is bad in our national life, But it would be even more foolish to ignore the vaster forces that tell for righteousness. Friends, there is every reason why we should fight whatever is evil in the present. But there is also every reason why we should feel a sturdy and confident hope for the future. There are many wrongs to right, there are many and powerful wrongdoers against whom to war, and it would be base to shrink from the contest, or to fail to wage it with a resolute will. But I am sure that we shall win in the contest, because I know that the heart of our people is sound. Our average men and women are good men and women, and this is true in all sections of our country and among all classes of our countrymen. There is no other nation in earth with such vast natural resources, or with such a high standard of living and of industrial efficiency among its workers. We have as a nation an era of an exampled prosperity ahead of us. We shall enjoy it, and our children will enjoy it after us. The trend of well-being in this country is upward, not downward, and this is the trend in the things of the soul as well as in the things of the body. Here in this country we have founded a great federal democratic republic. It is a government by and for the people, and therefore a genuine democracy, and the theory of our constitution is that each neighborhood shall be left to deal with the things that concern only itself and which it can most readily deal with, so that town, county, city, and state have their respective spheres of duty, while the nation deals with those matters which concern all of us, all of the people no matter where we dwell. Our democracy is based upon the belief that each individual ought to have the largest measure of liberty compatible with securing the rights of other individuals, that the average citizen, the plain man whom we meet in daily life, is normally capable of taking care of his own affairs, and has no desire to wrong anyone else, and yet that in the interest of all there shall be sufficient power lodged somewhere to prevent wicked people from trampling the weak underfoot for their own gain. Our constant endeavor is to make a good working compromise whereby we shall secure the full benefit of individual initiative and responsibility, while at the same time recognizing that it is the function of a wise government under modern conditions not merely to protect life and property, but to foster the social development of the people so far as this may be done by maintaining and promoting justice, amnesty, and equal rights. We believe in a real, not a sham, democracy. We believe in democracy as regards political rights, as regards education, and, finally, as regards industrial conditions. By democracy we understand securing, as far as it is humanly possible to secure it, equality of opportunity, equality of the conditions under which each man is to show the stuff that is in him and to achieve the measure of success to which his own force of mind and character entitle him. Religiously this means that each man is to have the right, unhindered by the state, to worship his creator, as his conscience dictates, granting freely to others the same freedom which he asks for himself. Politically we can be said substantially to have worked out our democratic ideals, and the same is true, thanks to the common schools, in educational matters. But in industry there has not, as yet, been the governmental growth necessary in order to meet the tremendous changes brought about in industrial conditions by steam and electricity. It is not in accordance with our principles that literally despotic power should be put into the hands of a few men in the affairs of the industrial world. Our effort must be for a just and effective plan of action which, while scrupulously safeguarding the rights of the men of wealth, shall yet, so far as humanly possible, secure under the law to all men equality of opportunity to make a living. It is to the interest of all of us that the man of exceptional business capacity should be amply rewarded, and there is nothing inconsistent with this in our insistence that he shall not be guilty of bribery or extortion, and that the rights of the wage worker and of the man of small means, who are themselves honest and hard-working, shall be scrupulously safeguarded. The instruments for the exercise of modern industrial power are the great corporations which, though created by the individual states, have grown far beyond the control of those states and transact their business throughout large sections of the Union. These corporations, like the industrial conditions which have called them into being, did not exist when the Constitution was founded, but the wise forethought of the founders provided, under the Interstate Commerce Clause of the Constitution, for the very emergency which has arisen, if only our people, as a whole, will realize what this emergency is, for, if the people thoroughly realize it, their governmental representatives will soon realize it also. The national government alone has sufficiently extensive power and jurisdiction to exercise adequate control over the great interstate corporations. While this thorough supervision and control by the national government is desirable primarily in the interest of the people, it will also, I firmly believe, be to the benefit of those corporations themselves which desire to be honest and law-abiding. Only thus can we put over these corporations one competent and efficient sovereign, a nation, able both to exact justice from them and to secure justice for them, so that they may not be alternately pampered and oppressed. The proposal need be dreaded only by those corporations which do not wish to obey the law or to be controlled in just fashion, but prefer to take their chances under the present lack of all system and to court the chance of getting improper favors as offsetting the chance of being blackmailed, an attitude rendered familiar in the past by those corporations which had thriven under certain corrupt and lawless city governments. The first need is to exercise this federal control in thoroughgoing and efficient fashion over the railroads, which, because of their peculiar position, offer the most immediate and urgent problem. The American people abhor vacuum, and are determined that this control shall be exercised somewhere. It is most unwise for the railroads not to recognize this and to submit to it as the first requisite of the situation. When this control is exercised in some such fashion, as it is now exercised over the national banks, there will be no falling off in business prosperity. In the contrary, the chances for the average man to do better will be increased. Undoubtedly, there will be much less opportunity than at present for very few individuals not of the most scrupulous type to amass great fortunes by speculating in and manipulating securities which are issued without any kind of control or supervision. But there will be plenty of room left for ample legitimate reward for business genius, while the chance for the man who is not a business genius, but who is a good, thrifty, hard-working citizen, will be better. I do not believe that our efforts will have anything but a beneficial effect upon the permanent prosperity of the country, and, as a matter of fact, even, as regards any temporary effect, I think that any trouble is due fundamentally not to the fact that the national authorities have discovered and corrected certain abuses, but to the fact that those abuses were there to be discovered. I think that the excellent people who have complained of our policy as hurting business have shown much the same spirit as the child who regards the dentist and not the ulcerated tooth as the real source of his woe. I am as certain as I can be of anything that the course we are pursuing will ultimately help business, for the corrupt man of business is as great a foe to this country as the corrupt politician. Both stand in the same evil eminence of infamy. Against both it is necessary to war, and if, unfortunately, in either type of point warfare, a few innocent people are hurt, the responsibility lies not with us, but with those who have misled them to their hurt. This is a rapidly growing nation, in a new continent, and in an era of new, complex, and ever-shifting conditions. Often it is necessary to devise new methods of meeting these new conditions. We must regard the past, but we must not regard only the past. We must also think of the future, and while we must learn by experience, we cannot afford to pay heed merely to the teachings of experience. The great preacher Channing, in his essay in the Union, spoke with fine insight in this very point. In commenting on the New England statesman Cabot, whom he greatly admired, he said that nevertheless he had too much of the wisdom of experience, he wanted what may be called the wisdom of hope. He then continued in words which have a peculiar fitness for the conditions of today, "We apprehend that it is possible to make experience too much our guide. There are seasons in human affairs, of inward and outward revolution, when new depths seem to be broken up in the soul, when new wants are unfolded in multitudes, and a new and undefined good is thirsted for. These are periods when the principles of experience need to be modified, when hope and trust and instinct claim a share with prudence in the guidance of affairs, when in truth to dare is the highest wisdom. These sentences should be carefully pondered by those men, often very good men, who forget that constructive change offers the best method of avoiding destructive change, that reform is the antidote to revolution, and that social reform is not the precursor but the preventive of socialism.